Ladies and gentlemen, welcoming to the Ray Carr Show is singer, actress, entertainer extraordinaire, Donna Loren. Donna, welcome to the Ray Carr Show here in Cleveland.
Oh, Ray, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Well, it is an honor to have you, and boy, the resume is unbelievable. The Dr. Pepper Girl from 1963 to 1968, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you were at Venice High School in West Los Angeles, and that's kind of where it all began for you. That's where you got the role for it. Is that correct?
Well, I'm going to take you back a little bit further, okay?
Okay.
Okay, well, there's a little community, a seaside community called Mar Vista in West Los Angeles. And that is actually where it started. I was labeled the Mar Vista Thrush at around 5 years of age. with charity events and various things that I did publicly. And so from there, I went to various schools and ended at Venice High for 1 year, because that's when I signed my little 7-year contract to be the Dr. Pepper Girl.
Yeah, Dr. Pepper, interesting. One of the oldest sodas, I would say, in the United States, but yet it's one of the ones that it just kind of stands out like no other. You know, Coke, Pepsi are big, but there's something about the Dr. Pepper Girl that just stands out. And even to this day, you think, boy, you just played that role so perfectly. And how, you know, from your perspective, talk a little bit about that experience.
Mm-hmm. Actually, my favorite thing to do in life is connect with people. And whether it's in person or audio or visual, through television, through films, you know, personal appearances. And the vehicle became Dr. Pepper for me to travel extensively throughout the United States in the 60s and constantly, you know, meeting people from every sector, every culture, and making friends, it seems as though for a lifetime, which is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it was, and you know, all those different people that you met, who were some of the people that you met along the way that really were instrumental in helping you later in your career?
Well, I would say Dick Clark. You know, he had me on bandstand several times promoting records that I was making, and then traveling with him on tour, which turned out to be the very first tour of the Supremes.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
Having that experience during a very difficult time, because he focused on traveling in the South in 1964. And, you know, with a mixed group, and that was a big no-no. But he took on the challenge, and we all followed. So I was only on one leg of the journey because I had a lot of different obligations. But he would go on a 3-month tour with mixed racially, you know, entertainers, and show up in places in the South during the civil rights movement, when it was not easy finding a place to sleep. You know, much of the time we slept on buses, and even just entertaining. I tell you, it's ironic, because it's almost as though the management or the ownership of the various establishments had those red flags up, you know, for mixed racially groups. But the audiences everywhere could, excuse me for my language, could give a damn, you know,
right.
Because music was a universal language, and it still is and always will be, and brought them together.
Indeed. Yeah, it really did. And you got to experience that probably at the time when it was going on. It didn't have the impact as it does today, looking back, and how important that experience was.
Yes. Well, I imagine, you know, in certain parts of the world, we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go.
Indeed. And also, some of the other things that you did that were very important, you were part of the American International Pictures Beach Party movie franchise. And, you know, one of the, you've been in so many great beach movies, and you sang a song with Dick Dale, I believe, Muscle Bustle. That was just remarkable. Dick Dale's a big, was a close friend and a, you know, mm-hmm. good fan of the show here. So what was that like working with Dick Dale?
Well, and may I also say his wife, Lana.
Oh, God, yes. Yes. God, yes.
You yes, are. He's yeah. a very dear friend and introduced you and I. Yeah. So thank you, Lana. Yeah, yes. Well, this turned out to be a song co-written by Brian Wilson, intended for him to perform it in the film. So he produced the track, which is the background music, and put on the harmonies in the background. So you may be able to distinguish Brian Wilson's voice there with Dick, and who was actually scheduled to be a solo artist. And then when I was brought on, suddenly it became a duet. So.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing, because most people, when they hear Dick Dale, they said, well, he's a, you know, great guitar player, but he doesn't really sing. But he actually does, and he sings very well, but nobody kind of gives him that credit. And to be able to do it with you was really kind of it's very exciting.
It was totally unexpected, yeah. I think, by both of us. But yeah, we had fun doing it, for sure.
Doing those types of movies, what are some of the things that you learned along the way that helped you later in your career?
Well, we had an incredible cast. I mean, for a campy sort of a B movie, the people that were involved, I think, have created it as a classic. People like, well, Frankie and Annette, for one, and right. And then the directors like Bill Asher and Norman Torog, and actors like, I mean, who knew Buster Keaton was going to be involved in a Beach Party movie?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And the likes of so many faces that you recognize and, you know, had these long standing careers in show business were part of these kind of culture, how do you say it, pop culture movies
yeah.
that not only talked about, let's say, an era and a West Coast sun, you know, fun in the sun kind of lifestyle, but you also had surf. And what I discovered traveling around the country was that so many people have never seen the ocean.
Yeah.
And the one way they were able to see it is through a film like this. And so it gave them an experience beyond the entertainment. And then it wasn't a trend, you know, it was kind of a subculture. And now it's available to everyone. So
yeah.
that was what I came out with.
There could be some kid in Des Moines, Iowa, that's never been out of Iowa and says, he sees a movie like that and says, wow, I want to go to LA and I want to be able to experience all that excitement that I'm seeing up here on the screen. And, you know, it's a good release. It's a good way for people to kind of get away from their day-to-day things that drive them, you know, crazy sometimes. And that's what entertainment is. And it's not always it's a good thing to kind of get away from it for, you know, a little while. And people that are able to deliver that are really gifted in what they do. Just like you, and you're a tremendous singer as well.
Thank you, honey. Well, everyone got along, and there were quite a few people in the cast and crew. You know, I'll just mention, for one, Floyd Crosby was the cinematographer, and he's the father of David from, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Wow. Wow.
So you had, you know, very, very high-quality professionals coming together for these campy movies, which, you know, we never knew would live on for all these decades. And but we seriously all had this kind of equanimity among us to, you know, be part of something, you know, as a whole. And, you know, there was no sense of fragmentation where one was doing this and one was doing that. Little Stevie Wonder, you know, was performing with Don Rickles hosting, and, you know, yeah. We all came together like a happy marriage.
That is fantastic. And Shindig, another iconic music program, which debuted September 16th, 1964, with Jimmy O'Neill as the host. That was a different kind of show. That was a little different than American Bandstand. Can you describe the two different shows and how you look back on those?
Yes, Ray, you have really made a great point. there was a great, great English producer, and he was very, very close to the whole British scene, knowing Brian Epstein and the Beatles and the Stones when he was in England, and creating kind of a platform there initially to bring to America. And that's what Shindig was. He went a step further and kind of paralleled what Dick Clark was doing, and that is mixing it up with Motown artists and Philly artists and East Coast and West Coast and, you know, down south at the Atlantic Records. And you had this amalgamation of artists on one stage, creating this incredible vibration. And and it just happened to be when the Beach Boys were, you know, mega stars, and the Beatles were just coming on the scene, and the Stones and Kinks and Ray Charles,
right.
and James Brown and Marvin Gaye and Tina Turner, and, you know, Glenn Campbell was part of the cast. The musicians that were performing, not live. That's the one thing that television kind of did not allow for. And so all of the music was pre-recorded to live vocal performances. And that was just for sound. And I guess whomever made that decision was right on, because the sound was unparalleled. But the buzz that Jack Good, the producer, created was, again, this, you know, sense of unity and coming together and elevating everyone's feelings, not just a sense of excitement, but a coming together again, and based on music from every corner of the world. And really showing appreciation for being a Brit who, you know, reflected the influences of early American music and R&B and soul, and then it blossomed into the British invasion.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing when you think about the American music goes to England and it comes back. They take it and they give it back to us in a different form. You know, it's just... It was very unique process. The Yardbirds were taking American blues music and bringing it back to us in a different way, which eventually transformed into bands like Cream and Led Zeppelin and things like that.
Indeed. Well, you are more of a historian than I am, but I know that, you know, Muddy Waters and people like that were a great influence on the Stones and the Beatles and Chuck Berry and people like that, you know. They would never, and Elvis, you know, they would never be who they are without that influence.
No, absolutely not. Let's not forget Bo Diddley either, but he was he was one of my personal favorites.
Great.
Donna Loren, our special guest. Donna, if I remember correctly, now I may not, but I think I got this one right. There was a show called Celebrity Party, and you sang a song called Bill Bailey. Was that correct? I mean, talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was signed by Dr. Pepper, it was in the month of June, I believe, of 1963, and I had just turned 16, and by September, I was already doing a series of TV and radio commercials, and by the next month, I was back in Los Angeles where I lived and told to be at this address. I was a minor, so I was always accompanied by my adopted father, and he became my manager as well. But the show was a live show, and it was put on film of celebrities that lived in Los Angeles gathering at a manager's house in the Hollywood Hills. And that was Bob Marcucci, who managed Frankie Avalon and Fabian, and I, that's enough for me. Yeah. So we all showed up, and I really did not know what the itinerary was. So when I arrived, I was dressed and ready to go, handed a microphone, and introduced it to Clark, and Dick said to me, okay, let's go host the show. And away we went, and then, you know, suddenly I was told, okay, you're going to be promoting your latest record, so, you know, you'll be here, you'll be there, and we'd like for you to do a live performance, and here's a piano, and here's some musicians, and so it was all very impromptu, and we just all went for it, and captured on film.
Wow. Yeah, it's, there was also... the other song, I Can't Make My Heart Say Goodbye. That was another one, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Donna, what were some of your favorite songs that you thoroughly enjoyed singing over and over again?
Well, certainly, It Only Hurts When I Cry, the song that I sing in Beach Blanket Bingo.
I love that one. Yeah.
you know, it started out with an upbeat, and then later on in life, I decided to tone it down. And then when I have a little book published with my photo archive called Pop Culture. It's called Pop 60s by me and a collaborator, Dominique Priori. And I was invited to perform that at a kind of a book launch event in San Diego called Tiki Oasis. I think it was 2015 or 2016, I can't recall. And actually, it's being republished. It's been printed twice, and this is going to be the third time, fortunately, for me and for fans.
Yeah.
So getting back to what you were saying. Please help me. I'm wandering here.
No, I know. I just wanted to also add, you know, you can get the book online almost anywhere, Amazon, but is there another place that you would like people to go to get the book?
Oh, you were asking me about songs.
Yes.
Yes. Well, you can go to my website, you know, donnalauren.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
But songs in general that you enjoy singing over and over again that, I mean, have resonated with you throughout your career that, you know, you get behind the mic and they just, like, they're magic for you.
Thank you. Sometimes, you know, one needs, especially creative people need some guidance, you know, to keep them on track. So thank you, Ray.
Sure, my pleasure.
Yeah, well, I ended up learning a song when I was 15. That was originally sung in French by Edith Piaf, and I learned the English version, If You Love Me, which ended up being performed on Bandstand and lots of other places live. And that is one song that is near and dear to my heart. So, yes, I love singing that song. And then I go back to an Irving Berlin classic, you know, Always.
Oh, yeah.
Which I learned listening to Patsy Cline because I love her voice.
Oh, wow. Yeah. She was incredible. Perhaps one of the greatest singers of all time, not just country, but, you know, I go to pieces and crazy, and anything that she did was fantastic.
Well, I'll give you a little secret tip. There was a show called Mad About You starring Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt.
Yeah.
And there was an episode where he was proposing to her at a roller skating rink, and they played Crazy in the background. But the budget didn't allow for buying the licensing of the original with Patsy Cline. So the music director knew me and said, would you do me a favor? So I did. And I just volunteered to do a version of Crazy. And that's what you hear in the background when wow. he's proposing.
Wow. I'm going to play that on my show tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great song. Willie Nelson wrote it, but it's just a remarkable song. And wow, it's just unbelievable. Donna Loren, our special guest. Donna, if I may switch directions here, I'm looking at a picture of you kissing Burt Ward. And you were on many different TV shows, Dr. Kildare, but Batman and Robin, one of the shows that even to this day lives like it was still on TV. People talk about it all the time, the celebrities. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the experience working with Burt Ward and Adam West and Neil Hamilton and great people like that.
Well, I have to say Cesar Romero, who played the Joker.
Absolutely, yes, and Burgess Meredith. And, yeah, it goes on and on. There's so many incredible actors and actresses that were on that show for only a two-year period, too.
Yeah, well, when I was hired to do that, it was new, but I could feel the buzz, you know, driving up to the gates of Desilu Studios. And actually, that was in Culver City, I'm trying to remember. And the, you know, the guard gate where you enter was lined up with groupies trying to climb the fence, getting a little sneak view of Batman and Robin, maybe even the Batmobile, you never know. But they were a joy to work with and, you know, very, very welcoming. And it was a good experience. I have to say my role was interesting because I had never played a part like that. And, you know, bad girl gone good. So that was different. And I should say that the outfit that I wore at the very end, it was kind of like a mustard colored mini dress with a jacket. I still have, that's one thing that I guess when I auditioned for parts, people knew that I like to wear my own wardrobe, and some of it I designed myself and made myself. And so I do have that in my wardrobe. And about maybe 4 years ago or so, at the Hollywood Museum, there was an exhibit of Batman and some of the costumes of the various characters. And so my little outfit was put on display for almost 3 years until COVID hit, and then things kind of slowed down.
What was the most enjoyable moment you ever had doing any TV show?
I think it goes back to Shindig. It's that incredible experience of being with so many creative people and a live audience, and the pacing and the music that was all coming together on one stage, the sound that was coming, and the spontaneity of everyone. You know, you knew that, you know, we were the number one show in the nation at that time. And that, you know, when you looked in, at least I felt, when you looked in the camera, you knew you were singing to millions of people and touching their hearts and hopefully their souls and something, giving them something they could remember for always.
Yeah. What was Jimmy O'Neill like to work with?
What a sweet man. Very, very kind. And generous, and married to a woman named Sharon Sheely, who was also a songwriter. And I don't know. I can't tell you what song she wrote, but maybe you can look it up. They were a great team together and very supportive of me.
Yeah, it was. He had. Just a great personality. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Jimmy O'Neill, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I saw him on the Flintstones the first time because he was Jimmy O'Neill Stone when the Flintstones were on Shinrock and opposed to Shindig.
Oh, that's sweet.
So that's where I really got my first taste, because at the time I was too young to understand it. you know, pop music really wasn't something a 3 or 4 year old kid would understand. So you watch the Flintstones, you kind of go, hey, I understand that. So that's where I got the first taste of it. Yeah.
Well, I guess I have to throw you another curveball because my adopted father was one of the animators for the Flintstones.
Really? Wow, Hanna-Barbera, amazing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Wow. It's, you know, you think about Hanna-Barbera and the stuff that they put out in the 60s, the Jetsons, Top Cat, the Flintstones. They also did Huckleberry Hound. They did Quick Draw McGraw. They did, you know, all those in Magilla Gorilla. What, you know, the stuff that was just, you look back on it as an adult, I do, and go, I still like watching that those great TV shows.
Well, yeah, because there was an art form called full animation. You know, it's not the kind of animation you see now. You go back to Disney and you look at Fantasia or any of the classic movies from the 30s and 40s and even up to the 50s, where my adopted dad also worked at Disney. And, you know, that is called full animation, where, you know, there's so many frames to every minute that you see the full, you know, let's say it's a handshake. You see the, you know, from start to finish, not kind of segments in between, limited animation. And then the colors that were used and the artists that performed all the, you know, all this technique. Nothing was digital. It was all by hand.
Right.
So,
Donna, let me... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think, you know, it's the quality of work that creates the masterpieces, I believe, and just lives on forever.
Yeah. Is there a particular Hanna-Barbera cartoon or episode of a cartoon that resonates Ooh. With you more today than ever before?
Well, I kind of like, help me out here. I was a busy girl, but Yogi Bear. Yogi Bear and Boo Boo Bear, I used to enjoy them, but I can't tell you specifically.
Mine was when Fred Flintstone became Santa Claus. Santa got sick, and then Fred took over, and he was able to deliver all the presents to all the kids of the world, you know, back in the, it was a 1965 episode, I believe. But anyway, that was my favorite, you know, when Fred was kind of
That's amazing.
Yeah. Donna Lauren, our special guest. Donna, once again, let's talk a little bit about some projects that you've done recently. The Love It Away, that was 2010, and Donna does Elvis in Hawaii. Talk a little bit about those two, if you can.
Yes, oh, Ray. Love It Away kind of came to me when I was really distressed about the kind of mood that was happening. It was almost like a shadow that was coming to our planet that, you know, I was willing to look at the dark side, but I was also seeing the reflection of the light. And I see emotions on this earth in two categories, either love or fear. And I just knew in my heart around 2008, 2009, when, you know, this country went into an economic crash, that, or actually it started, 2007?
Yeah.
That I went, you know, I had to make a choice. Either, you know, become fearful, because you can't really, in my way of saying it, you can't keep one toe in fear and another toe in love. I had to make a choice. And so this little song came to me called Love It Away. Love the darkness, love the fear away, and invest all of your thoughts and all of your consciousness in the emotion of love. So that, and then that spawned half a dozen songs that I wrote, which just kind of came to me. And I was fortunate enough because I was living in Hawaii, and I met a wonderful man named Charles Brotman, who was a musician and had a studio nearby where I lived. And so I started recording there, along with doing Skype with my associate in Los Angeles, who had a studio. And we did this almost like what we're doing now, you know, as a common saying of communicating long distance and trying to overcome the distance, you know, by through technology. So that's how that album came to be. And then I had a wonderful photographer from Honolulu that came over to the Big Island where I was living and did the photography. And then when it was time, you know, I got the message, it was almost like a message from spirit, that my husband and I decided to come back to the mainland, come back to California, where I'm from. And I wasn't born here. I was born in Boston, but lived my life in California, and come back to my roots where my children are. And I was about to have a grandchild. And so, oh, good timing. And, but it was so, so, so emotional to leave Hawaii. I'd been, lived there for 15 years by then. And so I thought about Elvis. I thought about his love of Hawaii. I thought about how much he was loved in Hawaii. And then going back into the 80s, I was doing some recording and James Burton, who used to lead Elvis's band, decided to work with me. And so we went into the studio and did One Night. And oh, wow. that was incorporated into three new recordings that I did in Hawaii. Just my fond farewell to a place that I love.
Yeah, the king of rock and roll, my goodness. Is live broadcast from the satellite broadcast in 1973 from Hawaii was one of the biggest ever seen on TV at that time.
Should be. Yeah. And let me just veer off as you were leading me. One of the songs that I sang in one of the Beach Party movies, I think it was Bikini Beach, was called Love's a Secret Weapon.
Yes.
So when the pandemic started, I was thinking to myself, what in the world can I do, you know, to contribute on a creative level? And so I had written a memoir with a collaborator in Australia, doctor of psychology, named Adam Garate, and I asked him if we could start a podcast. So we did, and we called it Love's a Secret Weapon. And I began reading my memoir with Dr. Adam, who was analyzing my story as we went along. And we are up to episode 36. And now I'm inviting fans to be guests on the podcast.
Oh, that's and, great. That's great.
And it's so much fun, you know, just, you know, overcoming the barriers that we're living with and the distance that we're living with, and just bringing people closer. And it's just very, very rewarding.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you what's rewarding is speaking with you. And it's been a true honor, Donna, to be able to talk to you about, you know, all the great memories and all the things that you're doing. And I just hope I have the opportunity to speak with you again.
That's marvelous. I appreciate it, and I look forward to that, Ray.
Okay. Have a great holiday.
You as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I really, really appreciate it. And if you talk to Lana, tell her I said hi.
I certainly will, Ray. Happy, happy holiday. Stay well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.